Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and supporters. I'm Henrik. Great to have you with us. I hope your weekend was good. We have a lot of irons in the fire right now and a lot of good shows coming up. It's as busy as ever. We haven't really had the time needed to go through all the emails from the good folks that sent us notice of interest to participate and work with us. We are going to line up everything for our upcoming development in April now, and then we're going to begin to look over in detail what we can do to move ahead with those that have shown an interest. So definitely stay tuned for that, and thank you for your patience on that as well. We'll complete one thing at a time here and then work our way forward from there. A lot of things going on right now. So more news about the developments is coming soon. So let's just dive into today's show here now. Our guest is Stephen Flowers. He's also gone by the pen name Edred Thorsson and has been instrumental in the early establishment of Germanic neo-pagan movement in North America and has also been very active in left-hand path occult organizations. He has over 36 published books and hundreds of published papers and translations on a disparate range of subjects. Flowers advocates esoteric runology and runosophy and Odinism, that is the occult aspects of Germanic neo-paganism. Now, Stephen has a wide range of topics that we can talk about here today, but our main focus is going to be about the revival or rejuvenation of the Indo-European or Indo-Aryan way, the tradition, through a revival of well-founded Germanic traditions that are actually being eliminated and pushed out from academia right now. If we don't save the knowledge and traditions and spread it like our culture, it will be lost forever. Welcome, Stephen Flowers. Great to finally have you on the program. I've wanted to get you on for, I think it's a few years now, so it's definitely a treat for me to finally get you on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here and happy to speak with you today.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, you're a lot of things. You're a former American professor. You're a scholar, runologist. You're into occultism or the left-hand path, if you will. Also into esoteric runosophy, Germanic mysticism, Ossatru, of course, and Mazdaism. And I mean, One of the things I really want to get into here today is the restoration or the establishment of the Indo-European religion. But what do you think listeners should know about your work for new listeners and maybe newcomers to your material to get an idea of the scope of your work and some of the things you've been through in your career?
Well, this restoration of the Indo-European way, if you will, is really a root idea that I emerged from and then I'm looping back towards in my work with the Germanic tradition. It really emerged in my academic environment from an Indo-European root. My mentor was Edgar Polamé, who was a great Indo-Europeanist, founder of the Journal of Indo-European Studies. And although his main focus was Germanic studies, he was also a Sanskritist and he was a master of the whole gamut of Indo-European studies. And the idea there is that there's some root idea that remains mysterious because it is so deeply buried that we have to use all kinds of methods of inquiry in order to bring it alive within ourselves and within our intellects as well as our souls. And so, you have to start with some tradition that is well founded, such as the Germanic one, and learn that and delve into that, and then start spreading your roots, as it were, into these various other things. Where I differ from the purely scholarly standpoint is that I see that why I am studying these things or why I studied these things was not just for an idle curiosity cabinet of intellectual artifacts, but rather studying these things for a purpose of making a difference in my own life and in the life of the world, if you will. It's right. Practical and applied, not just something to get a job in academia with and spin a lot of words. And that was not my aim from the beginning. And so that's where I came from Although as I entered into academia all those many years ago, I was already interested in these things. It's just that I miraculously happened to be in a place where this person and these resources at that time existed. It's one of the unfortunate stories of the world, and it has happening in Europe as well as in America, is that these areas of study are being eliminated. Anything before 1500 is considered to be too obscure and
right.
Not relevant, and politically correct cult and so forth has set out to eliminate these things largely.
Yep.
So that has been a problem. Back in the 1970s, when I was at the University of Texas, beginning my studies there, we had just the full gamut. It didn't matter what thing you were interested in. They were offering all kinds of things. Dr. Polamay had courses in early Germanic culture, migration age, Viking age, Germanic religion. These were all separate semesters to study. Now you could maybe get a course one semester on Vikings or something.
Really? It's changed that much, huh?
Oh, well, yeah. And also the professors that existed then will retire or die, and then they will be replaced by somebody who is just a linguist and just a operative, you know, within a very, with no imagination or any interests beyond the most sort of technical kinds of things. This recently, not too many years ago in Germany, another man I studied with in Göttingen in Germany, Klaus Duve, who is by no means, social democrat by political orientation
mm-hmm.
and complete liberal and everything, just the most fantastic guy you'd ever want to meet as a human being and everything. But the university there, runology was founded at that university by Wilhelm Grimm, by the Grimms, both of them, but especially Wilhelm, and they'd had this leading sort of runological studies there from that time forward, and in the route of 2000, around that time, the university in Göttingen just decided runes are something that is politically suspect, and we're eliminating that as anything that
right.
can be studied.
Of course.
It's not just in the United States, but it is a clear and obvious sort of pattern that has emerged. A lot of it has to do with sort of the dumbing down, if you will, of academia subjects or areas of study which are very difficult, where you have to learn foreign languages and obscure alphabets and things of that nature. That's just too much to ask. That's kind of their attitude. That's too hard. You are insulting the intelligence of these young men and women here by demanding that
really?
Of them. So that's
kind of
what's happening. And so people cannot, as I did, come into an environment and say, when I first started, I said, well, you can go to any university and study Old Norse and do this, that, and the other thing. And they, after about 20 years, people say, well, wait a minute, I can't. They don't have it. What's going on? And so then I discovered that this was being eliminated, and it was eliminated at the University of Texas also. I studied Old Norse, Old Irish, all kinds of things that they just don't exist anymore. So
wow, that's horrible. What do you think is driving this reformation and elimination?
Well, it's a political agenda, believing that things having to do with the study of Indo-European things, European Eurocentricism, et cetera, and so forth, is somehow racist or politically suspect by the people who run these universities.
Right, right.
So that was clear a long time ago, but that they would actually succeed so famously is rather disheartening. What's most disheartening is that then people cannot and also the expense here in the United States, the expense of universities have skyrocketed. I didn't have to take out any loans or anything like that to go to this university, and could study what I was interested in. But now the expense is so high for us that anybody who goes and studies ancient Germanic civilization and gets a PhD in it would have to belong to as they did 200 years ago to the idle rich,
right?
And to indulge that kind of thing, you couldn't be, you know, a normal middle class person and pursue that sort of thing. You'd be in debt for the rest of your life.
Wow.
So yeah, and in a way, see, by sending the expense of this kind of study so high, they then therefore eliminate it except for the elite.
Right, exactly. So you've really kind of, you were in the right window, I guess, to a certain extent, right? Because I've seen a lot of references and sources back to the University of Texas in my, as I've been searching around and looking for different things, and a lot of things has been accumulated there, it seems like. So, but that's no more then, basically?
Well, that's accumulated, still there. It's just that the human resources, the human beings who can guide you through this material and make it meaningful to you have been eliminated. The objects, the books, the whatever, like that sort of thing. We have one of the great Aleister Crowley collections there, for example.
Yeah.
And that would probably be still okay to study. But again, because you don't have to study. It's in the English department, for example, they just said, okay, to get a PhD in English at one point, say, well, you have to study Old English at least a semester or so. And they eliminate that. They eliminate Middle English, everything that's in any way difficult or hard as far as that level of objective difficulty. Then the process of education within the humanities becomes largely a political exercise of convincing your professors that you are on the same wavelength as they are.
Yeah, right.
But you never have to pass a test such as I would in all of these languages. So, well, sorry, we would like to for you to go on, but you simply can't read Latin, and you can't. You can't pass your exams in these difficult languages. Therefore, you can't go on. So we eliminate the difficult languages, and then it becomes an entirely political process.
So we're really losing this knowledge now, and I guess to a certain extent your studies, your attempt to write about this is really an attempt to salvage this knowledge, right?
Right, and to spread to make the interest in it and the access to it more broad. And like a lot of the things I'm doing, it's like, well, this has little chance of immediate success. Be great if it did, but at least seeds are being planted for the next cyclical process that inevitably comes around. So, but if the seeds are not planted and cultivated and nurtured, then knowledge of various kinds can completely die out if human beings don't step up and make the commitment to continue this kind of a line of thinking and to improve it and to bring it into a state of relevance to the present lives of people.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I have a lot of questions for you, obviously, about all of this, the many things I want to try to dig deeper into, but tell us first, why do we need this in our time? What is this, the value of this to us, do you think?
Well, it's I think it's an eternal, permanent value of our human existence. It is who and what we are as human beings. And even if someone says, well, this is just a game, and I don't even know whether anything that I'm living in here means anything, and whether I, well, there's anything to be gained by this in a permanent way, by what I endeavor to do in this lifetime. I don't care if you're that radically extreme in that direction. I would say that to play the game of life as if it did mean something, as if it did have some kind of continuity with the past and the future, that kind of life is a more meaningful and therefore happier life. And that ultimate aim and goal, if you will, from ancient times in this Mazdan tradition, for example, the oldest philosophical form of Indo-European that we have, is the idea of ushta, which is happiness. That is the aim. So why, and you say, well, why do you, what is the importance of it? There is no importance in the immediate here and now for anybody than happiness. And by doing that, by achieving and attaining that, then that is the best insurance that something, even if you're a doubter, you say, well, I don't know if anything means anything beyond this life or not, it will, you'll be happy here. And if it turns out that indeed what you did does mean something, then everything is well and good on all sides. So it's very practical. And if we were reduced at some point, and we could be quickly, very quickly, especially in our Western overly technological societies,
yeah,
we could easily be reduced to the Stone Age quickly. Because I recall some years ago a typhoon hit Bangladesh, and aid workers went in there and they said, oh, we're going to rebuild, we're going to help these people out. And by the time they got there, they'd already rebuilt their huts and things. And they said, we're fine. I said, well, you know, this typhoon would have sent you back to the Stone Age. Well, that's where we live.
Right.
I that's not a problem for us. It doesn't really, our hut got blown down, but that's no big deal. We can put them back up.
Right.
Or like in the Vietnam War, so we'll bomb to the Stone Age. Well, we're already there. That's not what, that doesn't bother us. But here, or in the Western cultures that are just, that if the power goes out, people go into a total panic. It wouldn't take much. The internet goes down, the power goes down, et cetera, and you're in Mad Max land.
Yeah.
Very quickly. And then the world, what is most important in those kind of worlds, then all of a sudden the realm of myth, organization, motivation of groups of people to defend themselves and to expand their spheres of influence to survive and to thrive in the world, you're right back to the Vikings overnight.
Right.
And those are that, and it will be, and it won't be the technologies that people have in that sense as much as it would be the myths they have that will make them succeed, will allow them, mm-hmm. will cause them to succeed. That in ancient times, it was those with the better myths who thrived, not with the better. I mean, everybody had a sword or whatever. We're all pretty even on what the kind of weapons we have. Mm-hmm. But how am I going to organize, motivate, and my society, and my men on the battlefield, and all kinds of things. So, for example, when William the Conqueror was headed off to England, he stood on the prow of the ship and sang verses from the Song of Roland, you know,
right,
which is this heroic, you know, song of the French and in old French. And it, but oh, why is that so? He's evoking this heroic world to motivate his men to do something heroic that day.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
That's and that wasn't just like, oh, I'm just singing a ditty here to entertain the boys before we go slaughter or get slaughtered or whatever's going to happen. No, that was a like a magic. Right? He says, I'm going to focus and direct the souls of these men to succeed.
Well, you know, one of the things I think you're absolutely right. I think it's incredibly important because we are we have lost something, I think, already. And the direction that progress to a certain extent has taken us and modernity is something that has pushed these stories and myths and the our own stories of our ancestors to the side. And I think that in that process they have, I mean, I don't know if we've solely have given them up, but to a certain extent I think that's true. But then it's what you said as well, that there's also an undermining of them. They are consciously pushed to the side because they somehow, someone had made a moral value judgment upon them and says, well, time for that is over, right? But I think that ultimately this is leading to our demise, right? That we're so devoid from these original tales and our own identities, or to a certain extent, that this is hollowing out the whole Western world, Europe and America.
Right. And people don't realize, of course, that I'm sure a lot of people listening are familiar with just the idea that this process is not a recent one, and it's not one that is rooted in the 19th century and Marxism and that sort of thing. It's continued by that kind of thing, but it's the ultimate roots of it go right back to the so-called to the Christianization process, to the adoption of or the forced and the adoption of an idea that for which there was no understanding or sympathy, but it was a political conversion, if you will, and then but of course most people don't realize just how unconverted people remained for centuries, that there was no conversion. That's a bad term to use. It's just a Christianization. But most people throughout the Middle Ages continued in traditional thought patterns, even if they ascribed their thoughts to new images. People think of the whole process of Christianization can be observed in the Caribbean, for example, where people have only been exposed to Christianity for 300 years. Well, that's where you have things like Santeria and Macumba and things like that, but where they ascribe their pagan values to Christian images. Well, the same thing happened in Europe for centuries. It happens. That's the only way it can happen, because you convert people to a religion for which they have no understanding. There was no Sunday school teaching them even the value or the doctrine. People were just left to their own devices, and under such circumstances, they really continued without much guidance from their own traditional sources, but with just whatever remained of knowledge within the families, they continued to do as best they could for several centuries. So people don't really realize just how slow that process was, that it was not, we think of people who are Christians today, and we think, well, that's what happened back in the year 1100, or whenever people in a given country became officially Christian. So, well, they worshipped Thor, and the next day they were Christians, just like my father is, or my grandfather was.
Yep.
And it wasn't that way at all. It just doesn't happen that way.
Right. Yeah. And, the folk ways were clinging on to them for years and years, and even some of the saints adopted the roles and customs of older gods and goddesses.
Well, that's what there was a European Santeria. You can go to wherever in the Caribbean and see these people are practicing this thing where that's the way they think. And that's accepted. That's kind of a racist kind of way that scholars have. Says, well, it's okay for people in the Caribbean, for Indians or Africans or whatever to do that, but Europeans would never do that.
Of course, yeah.
You know, they would be, they're too, you know, oh, well, why not? That's the way it has to, that's the way it works. And that's just a sort of, it was very clear, a great book by James Russell, you've probably heard of it, called The Germanization of Early Medieval Christianity.
Mm-hmm, right. Yep.
And it kind of shows that. It's an old theory, but he really does it very well and within the context of comparative religion, not so much just realizing that this is nothing special. It's no special case for the Germans or the Germanic peoples here. It's just the way things happen in the world with these religions that have intricate doctrines that the populations being converted to these systems get no information. For example, in Iceland, they officially converted to Christianity in the year 1000, but for 100 years there were no priests there at all. No one was there to even instruct them. So what do you mm-hmm. think was going on for that 100 years? Then when the first priests came, they were like Armenian priests. and so they were talking generations of people that were living in a sort of a religious limbo. Also, of course, it's a misnomer or a misunderstanding when we think about these traditional societies, such as Germanic ancestors and so forth, to think that they sat there and said, well, Einar, what is our religion?
Right.
Religion, I mean, that where we are, that's why people who say, well, how is Germanic religion? Well, that's what we have, Germanic religion, Celtic religion, Greek religion. To be Greek was to speak Greek, worship Greek gods, and live in a Greek community, et cetera. This was all a total holistic way of life, which included spiritual practices of whatever sort. But it was not thought of as a religion separate from the rest of one's life.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things wherein when I studied about this Mazdan idea, this was really the beginning, but in a totally good way, as opposed to a bad way, in the sense that the Christian or way is kind of bad in the sense, or the Islamic or whatever, in the sense that people are converted to Christianity or to Islam through either overt coercion, in the case of most Christian stories, you convert or die, or in more subtle ways with the Islamic situation where they say, well, you know, we're an Islamic state now, and you non-Muslims are going to pay a higher tax than you Muslims.
Yep.
And then over a few generations, most people opt for the better tax deal.
Yep, that's right.
And so they, because most people aren't all that interested in religion per se. And so, but it's some kind of coercion. Whereas in one of the essential doctrines of the ancient Zoroastrian or Mazdan way was the idea that the whole notion or idea of coercion or even arguing with somebody to say, no, my way is better. Listen to me. I want to convince you that I am speaking the truth. You need to learn. No, that is not allowed either. It's just, here it is. Here I am. And then you have to come to it. You have to come towards it as a matter of your own conscience. That's the only
right.
legitimate thing. And actually, of course, because most of what, you know, Islam was sort of created in the image of Zoroastrianism, because it was like, we don't have any really too many ideas ourselves. So we're going to adopt a lot of these practices from Persia. And that was one of them. I mean, in the Quran, it talks about, you know, you cannot coerce a man into religion. Well, that's a Zoroastrian concept, which, of course, they ignored. But but it is the best idea concerning such a religion. It is a valuable idea in the sense that you can say, here is a system. Here is a way of thinking and practicing and believing, or how, whatever you want, a life way that is super tribal, that goes beyond tribal sort of lines, and you have to absorb this thing on your own and come mm-hmm. to it as a matter of conscience. When Cyrus the Great conquered country, Babylon or whatever, is famous for saying, well, you're a part of the Persian Empire now, but that means you continue to worship your own gods. So that's fine.
Right.
Whereas every other empire, constantly, even if it's the Roman Empire, just somehow they coerce the people in some kind of way, or overtly or covertly, to change their spiritual orientation. And that element of coercion and violence in connection with the spirit is something which is something that has to be avoided in when you are articulating ideas of that kind.
Right.
Yeah. That kind of spiritual violence is illegitimate because it just doesn't. Take. You can see that in the story of Marxism or communism in Russia. As soon as the coercion is removed, then the belief is removed.
Yeah, that's right. Well, isn't it you know? Kind of the same? I was thinking about that when you were talking about how, you know, in some of the Caribbean islands and whatnot, Christianity has been very, just a few hundred years there. Mm-hmm. Similarly, Scandinavia too. I mean, Christianity came very late, and it mm-hmm. didn't stay that long. To be honest, we had a fervent few hundred years there where we participated in, you know, an expansion phase, and then part of the 30 Years' War and that kind of stuff. But then now, unfortunately, though, we have fallen back, I guess, to kind of an atheism as opposed to going back to our original spiritual mm-hmm. heritage. But nonetheless, it shows that it just didn't stick, right?
Right. Well, that's one of the things I have the hope. For this idea of the Occidental Temple of the Wise Lord is that we take an Indo-European model of spirituality, which is trans-tribal and philosophically solid, and it exists on a completely abstract level, if that's the way you want to think of it. In other words, an atheist could embrace it and do, or a person who believes in the gods or whatever, the angels and archangels and all of that sort of thing, in a very sort of fundamentalist kind of way. I mean, it's just not mandated as to how one approaches that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you find a similar thing in India in Hinduism, where you have Vedanta or whatever. Some people are virtual atheists, but they still belong to that tradition. So that people who are atheistic in the sense that they might have a idea that there are elements of consciousness and there's morality, there's good, and so forth. But there's no personal God that sits there like an anthropomorphic entity. And that's something that is within Zoroastrianism is completely avoided. That the Ahura Mazda is an entity, but it is not male or female. It's considered Ahura is masculine, Mazda is feminine. This entity is the father and the mother of humanity and the world as a creator, but it's not. It is completely beyond all attributes, except that it is light, it is good, it is powerful, it is all-knowing because it is wisdom, et cetera, and so forth, which is really the origin, as they come out and say, many Greek philosophers in ancient times would say, that this idea that the philosophical tradition in Greece of the Socratic kind of, and even pre-Socratic, came from contact with these ideas from the East, from the Persians, and which is a very simple idea, the idea that, hey, the gods are not men, big men and women floating around in space with all the foibles and jealousies like the Greeks. I just think of Greek mythology, but I also warn people or tell them, so really, the Bible is no different. The God described in the Old Testament is pretty much the same kind. It's just like a Zeus. He's jealous, angry, fearful, all of these things.
Right, yeah.
So that's no different than Zeus is described in Greek mythology. It's just that the people who are Christians or whatever are preconditioned to say, this is a profound and true book, therefore it is true, and other things we can disparage. But when you really analyze it, no, this deity, just as described in the book, is a rascal, you know?
Right.
And really from the philosophical perspective of Mazdaism, no other conclusion can be reached than this entity as described as the creator of God within the book of Genesis in the Hebrew Bible is actually a demon, not a god.
Right, yeah.
Because the true God, Ahura Mazda, the wise Lord, has created humanity to fight against, and they've all volunteered, all people who are incarnated have volunteered their souls in the supernal realm to come here and fight for the good against evil, and they are all destined to salvation, or salvation, I use that word, but you know, it's perfection and immortality, because that's where they began. So it is only logical to say this is where they will return. And so that is, and that to, how is that done? Through gaining of knowledge of what? Of good and evil. And of life eternal. This is what Ahura Mazda wants for humanity, not to punish them for trying to attain it. That would be the role of a daiva, of a demon.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting.
So that, of course, that's where the Iranian origins of Gnostic ideas. Well, they've
right.
been melded it into Judeo-Christian mythology, but that's why the serpent is seen as good, because it's trying to convey knowledge to humanity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's all it's been turned on its head, hasn't it?
Yeah. But of course the whole, even the myth that is relayed in the book of Genesis is of Iranian origin. They just screwed up the meaning of it.
I wonder if they did screw up, but that could be argued, I guess, or if it was intentional.
Well, they screwed it up in the sense that the man, the position of humanity, is seen as turned around and made man then becomes culpable for his condition,
right,
rather than saying you are good. Your only problem is you are not properly doing the right things and properly following and fighting against the things and resisting the things you need to resist and following and doing the things you need to do. But it is your irrevocable destiny to eventually do the right thing. But it is not because you have made the wrong choice. You made the right choice. You made the choice. And that whole idea of the choice being one, that it is the choice, an original choice was made, it was the right one and the good one. because they're Fravashis, like the Valkyrjur in the supernal realm, chose to incarnate and come to Earth to fight. So that was the right choice. So it was not original sin, it was original merit. And for that original merit, humans will be inevitably and irrevocably rewarded with perfection and immortality, as opposed to making the wrong choice, and that the choice you made, or that Adam made, you didn't make it, that Adam made, this other person you have nothing to do with and are not responsible for, that choice of that entity condemns you to a state of damnation, unless, you know, God gives his grace and allows you to be good. Rather, it is said that humanity is by nature good, and well, if and only by making the choice, not that one choice was made which conditions all time, but rather one choice was made which gave the destiny of perfection. But you have to make, humans make choices every second, every minute, every hour of every day, to go one way or the other. You make the right or the wrong choice in everything.
Yeah.
And that is a constant, ongoing thing. And so professors, I mean, this Professor Irani, he's an old guy, maybe dead now, but a New York University guy from Iran. He was a professor of philosophy, but he was also a Zoroastrian. But he taught the whole idea just totally from an existentialist perspective of making these choices as a human being. And that could be understood completely within that context without necessarily doing anything else.
Right.
You know,
Well, let me, it's very interesting, and it's definitely on a, you know, deeper, of course, philosophical level. I do want to return to that a bit later. I did want to ask you, though, in terms of, I'm very interested in the connection here between the formulation of the Germanic tradition, if you will, or religion, if you prefer that word,
mm-hmm.
how that came together from a standpoint of Zoroastrianism. I mean, did your interest begin in kind of the Norse sagas and the Germanic tradition, and then you were seeking to get further back to kind of a source point, or what was the development there?
Well, you could basically say that. I had some exposure to Iranian things in mysterious ways from before I was even interested in Germanic thing, but nothing serious. It was just that certain seeds were planted in my life. I left high school here in the United States when I was 18. I went to Germany and studied at the Goethe Institute, and there I met this individual. This is 1971. And this man that was a part of the Ministry of Information or whatever they called it in Iran at the time, and it was exactly that year when the Shah of Iran had that 2,500th anniversary of Iranian monarchy celebration mm-hmm. at Persepolis and all of that sort of thing. So this guy was all excited about all that, and we saw things in Germany at the movie theater when they used to have newsreels and things like that, and they showed this stuff, and he was all enthused about it. He was talking about it, and it was just very impactful to me. And then from that time on, I was always interested in this kind of world, but I was studying Germanic things and studied all the way to getting a PhD in Germanic studies, and studied Old Norse and all that sort of thing. And that was my area. That's what I was devoted to, because I went on the theory, which is a good one and a true one, and the one that I absolutely always believe in, that we are our easiest, if you will, quickest and most natural a point of access to this deep level of knowledge is something which is tied to our ancestry, to our physical cells, and to our culture. That we grow up, we speak a Germanic language, we live within a Germanic cultural sphere, increasingly less so, but within the historical framework. And so if we start to go back through the patterns and through the labyrinth of things to try to get to the meaningful juice of life through myth and so forth, that the going back through that which we are directly and viscerally connected to would be to me, that's the way to go. Now, I understand that is the way that is most tabooized by the Christians because, you know, going back, not Christians now in the pulpit, but rather going back to the Middle Ages because that was their whole kind of a fear that people would revert to, and which people did, of course, often revert back to their native traditions. That was what they had to oppose, not interest in Buddhism or American Indian sweat lodges or whatever. That doesn't threaten the church. But right. Going back to your own roots, the thing you came from, going back down the same road they drug you off of, is dangerous.
Yep.
Has a special status of danger. But I think it has a special status of danger because it is the one that is most likely to work, to stick, to be real.
Right. Yeah.
And all of those ideas are the ideas that sent me down the Germanic road. And then there I met and came in contact with this idea that, well, the Germanic thing is not an isolated thing. Rather, it is part of a great system and comes from somewhere, comes from a root or a trunk or a branch. And Germanic people only articulated themselves out as a separate people somewhere around 700 BC. Well, it goes back much further than that, obviously, to the Indo-European substratum, et cetera. And so you go back in time and space to even more fundamental and basic things, which are increasingly more eternal because it becomes the wellspring, the source from which not only things were happening 2,000 years ago, but from my perspective, the wellspring from which things still emerge. And those things are, if you, in reality, in their deepest sense, they don't have the culturally conditioned images. They are just direct, almost physical, chemical, spiritual, whatever you want to call them. They are paradigms or patterns of existence which are like a chemical compound, like a form of light, whatever metaphor you want to create for it. And when they manifest, just like in our dreams, we have dreams, but we clothe the meaning in some kind of imagery. It could be people we know or whatever, but the meaning of it is not the images and the forms are gateways, but they're also veils for the actual meaning of things. And I think that's true in life and in existence in general. What we see, image is not reality. I mean, this is something Plato tried to teach. If it's popular and people, it's guaranteed not to be true. The image is guaranteed to be a lie, something which is obscuring the truth rather than some. But if some of it's a mythic image or a poetic image, that sort of thing, then there is that element of a gateway between truth or reality and the external appearance. And but the thing itself is not like Thor. Is not, oh, he's a guy. He's got a big red beard. He's got a chariot. He's got goats, and he's thundering across the heavens, you know, fighting the giants. Well, there's a truth to that, but none of it has to do with the peculiarities or particular details of that cultural image.
Yeah, I think there are actually people that think that, you know, that you worship that image. They see it as a return to the Germanic tradition entails that you worship those deities in the same way that people worship Jesus or something, right? And it's very,
right,
very, very much different than that.
Yeah. So, but that exposes one's own self to a state of ridicule, you know, in the sense that you cannot be who our ancestors were. As I've said to people who think, oh, I wish I'd lived in the Viking Age, you know, I think,
right.
You would not last 10
no.
minutes
no.
in the Viking Age. All right.
No.
There's usually a guy, you know, sitting behind a computer somewhere, whatever. You know,
right.
But the point is that the reality, I don't argue with that these things are real, and they can show the way to a better future and to a better present also, but they have to be understood, or don't have to be, but I think they are best understood within the parameters of life as we live it today, and that they're still absolutely as meaningful now as they were then. It's just that one of the greatest misdirections that someone can undergo is to say, well, to do this, you have to, you know, dress up like a Viking and sacrifice a goat or something.
Right, right. Yep.
You see, and that's again where this Indo-European thing, where you say, well, where can we be have the philosophical sophistication which is necessary to life today in order to sort of find our way to this Indo-European model without having to, or without being pressed into or allowing ourselves to be seduced into these kind of false or erroneous beliefs concerning a kind of playing Viking or whatever and
mm-hmm.
so forth. So one
right.
of the things where the Zoroastrian thing is of interest is that here we have a tradition which goes back to probably somewhere around 1700 BC when this Zarathustra probably lived. We know that from the language in which he composed these poems, certain ones, the Gathas. And that tradition continues to this day.
Right. Yeah.
So it has gone, and these people have undergone. And we don't. And again, with the Occidental Temple of the Wise Lord, my idea is not to be a Zoroastrian. I don't use that word for what we do, because that is what they are doing. This is a separate thing, inspired by that, using methodologies, symbols, myths, and rituals that they use in an experimental, experiential way, but really all boiling down to the individual, and this is something that's incredibly important within that system, because each person is a individual soul, spirit, Fravashi, which is a kind of a demigod, which this is where the whole people say, my gosh, what are you doing? This is so foreign to the left-hand path that you sort of, you know, talked about. And in fact, it is absolutely not foreign to it. In fact, it is the embodiment of the most philosophically sound form of this, because within that this system, you find that there are, for example, every month there are 30 days in these ritual months, and each day is devoted to a different god or goddess, we'll call them that. But, you know, the Yazata is what they call them. And on the 19th, that's a day where we have all these gods, goddesses, other creations that are divine. On the 19th day, the entity to which devotion is given is the Fravashi, the Fravashis of humanity, of men, of women, of people who have been virtuous, whatever. So in a Germanic context, it's like you have all the gods and goddesses. But then on this day, we worship or give honor to the Valkyrjur, the souls of a heroic people, except insofar as all people, all humanity, have possessed this entity, and all will have the assignment of fulfilling, perfecting, and immortalizing that thing. And it is a matter not of God or Ahura Mazda saying, okay, you're okay, boom, you're it, you know, it's okay, you've made it, but rather you have to make the right choices, do the right things, etc., to attain to that heroic level.
Right.
And those entities are explicitly put into the pantheon of these entities that are worshipped, human souls, individual human souls, and all of them. So, see, that is saying, like, again, it's like, you want people to be good, you want people to do the right thing, to be, not only be happy, be all the things that are right and good. Well, you don't start off with the major premise of, you are a damned sinner.
Right.
You are a filthy, no good piece of crap. Now, if you do that to a child, they usually behave like a no good, filthy piece of crap.
Right. Yeah.
But if you say, no, you are a god, you are a goddess, you are destined to greatness, then all of a sudden people start to behave as if it's expected of them to do these great. And that's not
true.
Anything. That's just a technique of raising human beings in ancient times. It was why I say to people, you wouldn't last 10 minutes in the Viking Age, because all those other guys were raised that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were, you're a product of this.
I know, yeah.
And therefore you are not equipped to exist in that universe. And that universe in a philosophical and not technological, you are not going to be that comfortable in all kinds of things, but on this kind of level of soul, that is a superior world to ours.
Yeah, yeah.
But we, as one of my first sort of magical workings when I was just a teenager, I said, well, why can't we as a species have, you know, the technology, but have that too.
Right.
Why can't we have both?
Yep. Yep.
There's no reason why we can't. And I think at the moment we do have both. Then the time, as the Muslims call it, of the making wonderful will begin.
Well, Stephen, time's just flying by here. There's so many more things I want to get into and ask you about, but I think we should spend a little bit of time talking about the books, both that you have in the past, but also, you know, upcoming and whatnot, before we take a short break and then just continue the second segment. But tell us about the latest titles you have out right now.
Okay, well, I just, with Inner Traditions, just the most recent title is a book called Icelandic Magic, and that's available from Inner Traditions and on Amazon and so forth. And then I also have a book, which is a complete sort of outline, basic outline of some of the Mazdan ideas we've been talking about, called The Good Religion. And it is available from on Amazon also, but also from my website, seekthemystery.com. And forthcoming within their traditions is a book which is tentatively titled Original Magic, which is a kind of an individual sort of solitary guide to the idea of this of Mazdan practice. And it's magic because, of course, the word magic comes from magu, from the Iranian priests that were practitioners of that sort of thing. So that's forthcoming with Inner Traditions, also Original Magic. And so most of my books are available at this present time that are available are from the website seekthemystery.com or on Amazon in general. And of course, I also write under the name Edred Thorson.
Right, yes.
As people might know. But or Edred or whatever. Edred is my middle name. It was my grandfather's name.
Okay.
It was, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, definitely. I wanted to mention that exactly. If you guys check Amazon, definitely check under Edred Thorson as well, because some other titles show up under there. But yeah, seekthemystery.com, that's the main website. And heads up on the new titles coming up. And also how many books do you have out, by the way? How many in total? Do you know?
Oh, I don't. I think I've written somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 books of
there
one
you go.
Kind or another.
Okay, there you go. So lots for people to dig into. But do you mm-hmm. think, I guess, is it as usual that your latest work is always the best?
No, not necessarily. Okay. Not necessarily. Yeah. That's not true. But one book is actually going to be a three-volume thing, and the first volume is not available right now. It's called Northern Dawn, and it's a history of the reawakening of Germanic spirituality.
Nice.
In three volumes, first volume being the beginnings and sort of theory and the Middle Ages, the second one sort of the Renaissance and then the last one more of the 20th century kind of thing. And of course in that middle volume we get into Johann Bure and all that sort of thing, which I've
Johann Bure, the rune scholar that was actually appointed by the court, right, in Sweden,
mm-hmm.
1700s, yeah, I believe.
Yeah. Before I knew him of him, I sort of modeled myself on him in the sense
nice.
That he was a scholar, yes, and a leading great scholar, but he was also a practitioner of magic.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
He's well typical of a Renaissance man. That's just because now with our in modern the modernistic viewpoints, like, well, you cannot study this and actually believe it. Of course, again, that's a prejudice, because if a scholar of St. Augustine, he's not disqualified from saying you can't be a Christian and study St. Augustine properly.
Right.
But if you are studying Viking Age things, you can't believe or in any way ascribe value to these old Germanic gods. That disqualifies you. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so
true.
It's a double standard. And no one really, unless they've encountered it in life, they've been, oh, wait, that is true. It doesn't disqualify. Oh, you're specially qualified with special insight. That's, again, something that my professor, Edgar Polomay, recognized in me, that I had I've seen letters, which I wasn't supposed to see, but later on I did see them, where he evaluations of myself. And he pointed that out, that, you know, that I had special insight because I sort of immersed myself into this world, which is not a unique thing. He taught me part of that as the great scholar, Danish scholar, Wilhelm Grünbech, pioneered this technique or this hermeneutic, wherein in order to understand a culture foreign to your present time and place, you have to immerse yourself into the mythology, into the cosmology, into the psychology, into these underlying paradigms. You have to do that. Then when you read the myths and legends and things of that nature and study other things, to the degree to which you can do that, you view them through these lenses which you have learned about, rather than using your own modern lens to view these artifacts. and you come up with a totally different interpretation sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's see if we can get into actually some talk about some of the rune magic and whatnot in the second segment. There's all these interesting things there, and also how to, of course, bring some of these ideas and apply them to a certain extent in our modern age and all that. But we'll take a short break right here, Stephen, then we'll return with more. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. Proceed for another hour and a half with Stephen in the member segment coming up now right after the break. And Flowers begins to talk about ancient horse domestication and the profoundness of the great myth of the American frontier. Then Stephen explains the history of the Germanic writing systems called the runes and the relationship between the theory of magic and the mystical study of runes. We talk about rune magic, the use of artistic mythical components in conveying messages, and the function of the rune stones in immortalizing the dead and instilling motivation for group survival. We also touch on the application of runes in self-transformation, which Stephen says can be used to facilitate communications between one's conscious and unconscious mind and in activating the spirit. Additionally, Stephen gives recommendations for inspiring a sense of spirituality and purpose through self-exploration and bonding with other like-minded individuals in real life as opposed to just sitting in front of the computer all the time. At the end, we consider the Persian Empire's role in spreading the Aryan traditions of community and rights for all living things. Really interesting second hour is coming up. You definitely shouldn't miss it. To listen to this or any of our previous shows, sign up for a membership and get full access to our growing archives. It's only €6 per month, and we have 3 months up to 2 years available when it comes to subscriptions. We also have a 3-month recurring subscription where it conveniently auto-renews every 3 months for you. RedIceMembers.com is a website where you can stream or download this show or any of our previous ones. Over 1,000 in our archives now, and we're adding in several more each week. We have great shows coming up with Frank Raymond, Stefan Jakobsson, Blair Cottrell, and Thomas Sowell from Fortitude Australia. Stay tuned, second hour with Stephen Flowers, a.k.a. Edred Thorsen, is up next.